This episode of Monster Talk deals with some explicit sexual topics that may not be suitable for all listeners. You've probably heard or used the word gargantuan to describe something large. Did you know that that word is a literary allusion? It comes from a set of stories by Francois Rabelais about two giants called Gargantua and Pantagruel, first published in 1532. In these satirical stories, Gargantua, one of the giants, sets up a monastery of Thelema, and here is how it's described. In all their rule and strictest tie of their order, there was but this one clause to be observed. Do what thou wilt. Thelema means will. In 1904, a man named Aleister Crowley published what he claims to be divinely received wisdom as the Book of the Law, a publication which has become famously well known by shorthand reference to its similar command,
Do what thou wilt shall be the whole of the law.
One work, a famous literary satire. The other, a holy book of the magical religion of Thelema. Make of that what thou wilt. In this episode, we're going to talk about a man who gave himself more titles than a 1970s Italian horror film, including The Beast 666. His real name was Aleister Crowley.
It's actually quite unlike anything we've ever seen before.
A giant, hairy creature, part ape, part man.
In Loch Ness, a 24-mile-long, bottomless lake in the highlands of Scotland, it's a creature known as the Loch Ness Monster.
Monster Talk.
Welcome to Monster Talk, the science show about monsters. I'm Blake Smith. We're almost finished with my currently planned series on magic. I still want to talk about Jack Parsons and about Margaret Murray's book, The Witch Cult in Western Europe, but we'll be back to more direct monster coverage first. Though to be fair, there are many who would call the subject of this episode a real monster. We'll dig into some of the biographical material on Crowley in this episode, but if you check the show notes, there's some fantastic links if you're interested in seeing some contemporary coverage of his life. There's an interesting documentary from the BBC that was part of a four-part series called Masters of Darkness that covered Crowley in one episode. A fairly complete version of that's on YouTube, and I put links to that in the show notes. And there's a page with digitized copies of the tabloid coverage of his various exploits, some of which are shocking even today, or at least the claims are. He's famously been called the wickedest man in the world, and it seems to me like he would have just reveled in such epithets because infamy was as good as fame to him. He was a writer, a poet, a cult leader, and by many accounts, a total and complete bastard. In the documentary, a few career highlights show up. For example, he was a very good mountain climber, but then he had a scandalous episode where he allegedly refused to help his companions after an avalanche because of some falling out that they'd had. He bought a house on the coast of Loch Ness called Beleskin House and conducted a magical ritual there which was supposed to give him access to his guardian angel, but which required first to summon princes from hell. And then he didn't finish that ceremony, which led to rumors and legends about what failing to complete such a ritual could lead to. In the 1920s, he went to Sicily and started a church based on his religious teachings, but soon was deported because of the scandalous accusations that his cult had conducted bestiality, sacrifices, and some of the practices which had led to the death of one young member. He used up lovers and left them destroyed, and he spent much of his life enslaved by drug addictions. Yet somehow, he's seen by many as a kind of hero whose intent to harness the power of human will is, despite the failings of the man who brought the teachings, a path to a fulfilling life. The problem I have with talking about Crowley, especially from a position of wanting to be historically accurate, is that I can't tell what portion of the stuff written about him is true and what is complete bullshit. It is deeply frustrating. The majority of the news covers ridiculous mishmash of rumors and allegations and is not very different from the news stories from tabloids today. I can tell you this, though. His influence after his death has grown because of the fascination that many in the entertainment business feel for him. Many musicians have referenced him. Ozzy Osbourne's song Mr. Crowley, though it mispronounces his name, is just one example. Jimmy Page of Led Zeppelin bought Boleskine House and owned it for several years, and apparently owns a lot of Crowley's writings in addition to many other magical tomes. Crowley influenced other magical thinkers as well, and his religion lives on today. The counterculture of the 60s and 70s seemed to consider him a natural fit, though very little of Crowley's life comes across as particularly groovy. But let's get on to this interview, which is the third and final part of my interview with John L. Crow. Hopefully, across these three episodes, we will have provided some context to understand what was going on in the world to produce a man like Aleister Crowley.
Monster Talk.
Great. Okay, so in our previous discussion, we were talking about the rise of esotericism and occultism in Western civilization, and we talked about theosophy and briefly about the Golden Dawn. And our goal here is to guide into a discussion about Aleister Crowley. And could you give us a few biographical details about him and then how he gets involved in this movement?
Sure. He grew up very upper middle class. His father had a beer brewing business, Crowley Beer. And he basically had a strict environment, because although his parents were brewers, they were part of a very conservative Protestant denomination called the Plymouth Brotherhood.
A quick editorial correction. It's actually the Plymouth Brethren, and a link to more information about them is in the show notes.
And they stopped him from being able to participate in normal childhood activities with toys and playing with friends and all of these things that we come to expect children do for normal socialization. Instead, he had a more tumultuous of an experience. He was very dedicated to his father, and his father died when he was young. That caused a financial and social crisis within his family. He ended up living with some relatives he had negative experiences with, and then went to school and again had negative experiences there. So he had a very difficult childhood. And through that, he came to identify a lot of it with Christianity. So he started to rebel against the kind of Protestant strict religion, and instead he said, well, if the Plymouth Brotherhood were about God and Jesus rejecting the devil and being very conservative, I'm going to do the exact opposite. I'm going to embrace the diabolic, and I'm going to embrace hedonism. And so we could see by the time he is in college that he is indulging this lifestyle. He's starting to become educated in philosophy and science. He also has an interest in poetry, in literature. He is also interested in theater. So he's becoming very well-rounded, getting a very good education that that his economic status allowed. And so he ultimately rejects graduation, becomes a poet, and gets involved in various kinds of activities. And one of them is the Golden Dawn. So through a friend, he is introduced to the Golden Dawn, and he attends. And he's, by this point, has a very significant interest in esoteric subjects, occultism. And we should also look at the timeline, with theosophy beginning in 1875 and spiritualism, mesmerism, New Thought, all of these traditions being established or coming into being. It was a very potent environment for him to take these ideas and run with it. So he's encountered these esoteric and occult ideas from a variety of places, including the Kabbalah and so forth. So when he's introduced to the Golden Dawn, he's very, very apt, very eager, and he begins to excel in The Golden Dawn. It's also here, after a couple of years, that he meets Alan Bennett, who was considered the second best magician in The Golden Dawn, next to Mathers, one of the founders. And they get along very well. Crowley sees an opportunity because Bennett he's very ill and comes from a very poor family. Crowley says, look, if you give me teachings in magic, I will, put you up and give you a place to live and give you resources so that you can practice magic. And so they do. They get a flat. And so we see in 1899, they're living together. Crowley is getting lessons from Bennett, and Bennett's health is on the mend to some degree. So it worked out very well for them in these last 1890s. But already here, we see that Bennett had an interest in Eastern traditions. He was a member of the Theosophical Society early in the 1890s. And so eventually, Bennett will leave the Golden Dawn. And in that same time frame when Bennett leaves in 1900, Crowley is worked his way up to the Inner Order. But the members of the Lodge don't want him to enter the Inner Order. And so there we have this huge personality conflict.
But this is, he's coming out of a position of being upper middle class and from a university time period, right? So he's like a seeker and seeking education in a classical sense at the same time. Is that what we're saying?
Well, he definitely was interested in being educated, and he was very well read. He had access to lots of learning resources even before going to college, but he was coming from an environment that stressed education. So he was very literate. He read a lot, and while in college, he had access to philosophy and the sciences and literature. So he was participating in various degrees in both humanities and what we would consider STEM stuff. Within the context of the end of the 1900s.
Right.
But he was absorbing these ideas and really expanding them, because he wasn't limited in an ideology that said that there's no connection between these humanistic ideas and these scientific ideas. He was looking at them as part of a whole. And so one of the things that encumbers people in thinking about stuff today is they think, oh, I don't need humanities, I'm doing STEM, but they don't understand that minds and the world around us aren't categorized in kind of the disciplines. The way things manifest and influence and feed on one another are a lot more fluid. And so the boundaries that we create discipline-wise sometimes inhibit thinking. He was not participating in that. In fact, he was participating in a very unbounded thinking. So he would include esoteric knowledge and occultism along with literature and science. And they were all one big mix of ideas, influences that he had no problem pulling together.
So he's also he's at least bisexual, right? I mean, I'm a little.
Well, I think it's hard for us to deal with the fluidity of his sexuality.
Yes.
Using today's terms. Again, we very much are uncomfortable with things being undefined. So we have since the sexual revolution and feminism and all of this exposure to a variety of human sexual preferences, sexual practices, sexual modalities, people want to break it up into various kinds of categories of gay, lesbian, bisexual, queer, transgender. That's fine. But when you start projecting those categories back into a time period in which they didn't exist, it becomes a little more dicey. What we do know is that Crowley had love, emotional love for men and women, and that he participated in sexual activities with men and women. Now, some people want to say he's gay and that he really wasn't into women or that he was bisexual, or those debates in many ways, fine if that's what people, the direction they want to take it. But in some sense, those categories are not helpful because they're trying to bring in the reel in or bracket or close down his sexual activity. And the fact is, he participated in a lot of different kinds of sexual activity with different people of different genders.
So, let me ask it this way. So, I think one of the challenges I have as a modern, uninitiated reader or an interested party. I don't really know what to call myself. I'm curious about all this as it relates to magic. So a lot of times when I read about this stuff, it's Crowley participated in sexual rituals for magical purposes. And I don't know how that actually plays out as opposed to sexual encounters for merely hedonistic purposes or as part of long-term relationships. There's all these different ways to sort of categorize sex acts, but I'm curious about how sex magic works, because I keep seeing that phrase, sex magic and sex magic rituals. I have no idea what it means. I don't understand what, you know, is that like the magic is released through orgasm? I really don't understand it all. So like, if you have any insight to that, I would really be curious about what that means.
Well, sex magic has a large variety of manifestations. And if you think about what are the areas of human activity that have the most intensity, emotional connection, if you want to talk in terms of energy, build up the most, the largest pools of energy and engagement of an individual or individuals, and that would certainly include, if not be, led by sexuality. And so participation in sexual activity in a ritual context is simply using the various methods of sex engagement. And that could be anything from masturbation to intercourse of both men and women, or women together, or men together, or as a group of varying genders. All of these kinds of techniques are means to move consciousness or move energy or to consecrate an object to one's wills or desires, or to create a context for gnosis or access to a transcendent knowledge. So it really depends on what the goals are of the participants. It could be as mundane as you want something done. You create a talisman for it, and then you focus your will and notions about that and participate in masturbatory activities. And then with climax or something coming from that, bodily fluids, that consecrates the talisman. It could be as extensive as individuals participating in group sexuality and using bodily fluids or orgasm or the energy from it to consecrate things, or to get an individual or multiple participants in a state of consciousness that are receptive to mystical experience or knowledge. There's all kinds of different ways that it can participate. And some of the examples for Crowley and his sex with Victor Newberg is they had sex in the desert during their times in which they were doing Enochian works and scrying in the ethers. And so they would use sexual intercourse to get Crowley in a mystical state, and so that he was more receptive and could participate in scrying of Enochian ethers and so forth. So there's a large variety of activities that manifest sexually, and sex magic is basically harnessing those activities for magical ends.
Interesting. So I it reminds me of we did an episode on homunculus mm-hmm. and the concept of trying to create some sort of life with a single person. It's typically, the way I've read it, is a male, right? So I don't know if there's any rituals for making a female-based homunculus, but
there are rituals of sexual intercourse between men and women to create a homunculus. And if you think of the climax at a moment in which the male and female come together, preferably in simultaneous climax, to create the material basis, which then can be used as the grounding for the creation of a spiritual being, one that the goal of that spiritual being's existence is the culmination of the will of the participants.
Yeah, and I think that's that'll tie into some stuff we'll be looking at in the future, at least some of the stuff alleged to have been the goals of Jack Parsons, for example.
Right.
Yeah.
So that's exactly what Jack Parsons was doing.
Yeah. So it's really interesting. So but now, do you know is this part of Eastern religion, or is this part of Eastern tradition, or is this part of something that's come out of these esoteric movements that they claim is part of an Eastern tradition that's not? I'm finding it hard to kind of reconcile what is absolutely, you know, being repurposed and what's being sort of created ad hoc for these other movements. I'm not really sure how to word that exactly. But does that make sense? Like, what's legitimately part of Eastern tradition that they're repurposing, and what is maybe just created from their own interest in trying to get these results?
We don't know. The difficulty is, first of all, if you're talking specifically about sex magic, we're talking about a time period where people don't talk about sex that often. And when they do, they talk in veiled terms. So what is Eastern and what isn't Eastern really comes down to the claims of people. And there certainly are claims that the knowledge that they have on, for instance, somebody involved in spiritualism and the Hermetic Brotherhood of Light and P.B. Randolph, who was a mixed race spiritualist who also claimed to travel in the Middle East and become initiated and had sex magic rites and used hallucinogenic substances like hashish as part of magical ritual. Those claims are made, or similar ones by other people. We don't know. It is certainly not part of the exoteric practices of Eastern religions. Probably the one exception are high-level tantric practices that participate in sexual intercourse in tantric Hinduism and tantric Buddhism. But what people miss there is that the goals of those intercourse participations is not orgasm. In fact, orgasm would be considered failure in tantric practice. Instead, the goal is to maintain engagement in the sexual activity while building up energy and then taking that energy and using it for other means versus releasing it in orgasm. So when Westerners talk about tantra, they usually have it very, very wrong in terms of its resemblance of Eastern practice. That doesn't mean Western forms of tantra are wrong. They're just different. And that's the one thing that we should also keep in mind when we're looking at origins or looking for origins. In some cases, it doesn't matter. This is the what this teaching is from this group, and where they got it from could be invented, could be an amalgam of different sources or both. In some sense, it doesn't really matter. What matters is what they do with it and what they claim about it.
So I didn't want to take us down too big of a rabbit hole.
Yeah.
But I was just very curious about that because I read a lot in preparation for these interviews and nothing really broke it out very specifically. I was a little curious about what was sex magic and sexual ritual is an easy thing to say, but that's a broad category. That could be a lot of things. So I didn't really know what was under the hood.
it really is broad and it is multifaceted. And there are some scholars who have spent a lot of time looking at this and looking at esoteric traditions and the transmission of various kinds of sex-related religious practices and spiritual practices. And I don't claim to be one of those specialists, so I don't want to go too far down that subject. I think they would be better people to have on your show. But there is a lot there, and it is very interesting, and it would... and it does touch a lot on particularly Crowley and the OTO and also the other organizations in which Crowley participated in his AA and his magical teachings and subsequent students, because Crowley was one who was adamant of a positive correlation between magical practice and sexual activity. Whereas on the opposite side, someone like Blavatsky insisted on celibacy. So no sexual practice of any kind, including no masturbation, so that the person remains pure and focused and is not distracted by lust, sexual desire, or physical engagement of sexual acts. And so you'll actually see people within theosophy who are married stop having sex, or people getting married and having celibate marriages, or not even getting married ever because they don't want to participate in that kind of activity. And Blavatsky herself claimed never to have consummated her two marriages.
Huh. I've been married for like 18 years. I think our anniversary is tomorrow. So
congratulations.
It's not my way. Okay. It's like, no, honey, it's abstinence for sexual magical powers. Totally cool. So, yeah, I don't think I could sell that. So,
you know, most people can't. And in theosophy, what they said, especially during the time of Blavatsky, was, you know what, that's okay. Get married and participate the best you can. Just understand that your inability to discipline yourself in that sexual sense means that in this lifetime, you are not going to reach the highest levels of spiritual development.
Oh, well, I guess it's the price I have to pay. What?
Well, but on the other side, you know, you get people who are practicing Crowley system who's like, you're never going to get to the highest levels of spiritual development unless you participate in certain forms of sexual activity. It really just depends on the system and, you know, what its view on the body and desire and all of these kinds of things are. And that's why focusing on questions on the body and how the body is constructed and the use of the body in a magical and esoteric practice becomes really helpful in kind of getting into the ideas that are underlying it. Because if the body's bad, then all the wants and needs of the body become demonized, i.e. sexual intercourse. Whereas if the body is seen as ultimately good and is your connection to the world, then things of its needs and its participation in the world through sexual activity and other activities, then those are inherently good. So notions of the body, its construction, and the overall orientation to it becomes a prime indicator of what the ideologies of that organization or that system are.
Yeah, so with Crowley, he's over the course of like since he's left us, he's gotten this sort of legendary status. He shows up in pop culture. You see him in is it Black Sabbath or just Ozzy Osbourne, the Mr. Crowley song? I think that's although he says Crowley, but I think that's wrong.
It is a Black Sabbath song. He also shows up in, there's lots of groups. Black Sabbath and Ozzy are the most obvious, making a reference to him.
But Jimmy Page is a huge fan. Jimmy Page mm-hmm. goes on to buy Beleskin House, mm-hmm. and owns that for a while, which is where Crowley did some of his rituals. And
right.
So he's got this huge, maybe outsized pop culture presence outside of the direct religious side of him. So, like, in one sense, most people know him as sort of this dark figure in Western culture. And I think that's only dark in contrasted with Judeo-Christian views, right? I mean, I don't know how dark he is within magical tradition.
It's funny because he did participate and publicly announced his engagement in various kinds of sexual activities, various kinds of magical practices and so forth. And you're right, by more traditional or conservative Judeo-Christian morality, these things are seen as bad, which is also why he got, you know, the yellow journalism label of the most wicked man. But one has to wonder, when you start stacking up what he did in a larger context to people who have participated or engineered genocide, and sadly in the 20th century, we've had many political leaders cause or facilitate genocide. In comparison to that, I don't know how wicked he is. He never killed anybody. He never caused the death of groups of people or caused, whole territories or whatever to be destroyed or mass incineration of human beings.
Right. It's almost comical to say it compared to some of the sort of things that happened in the latter half of the 20th century. Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
To say you're the wickedest man in the world and, basically that goes down to, you know, breaking as many of the commandments as you can, that sort of thing. Within that context, yes, wicked, but within the sort of, I don't want to get into like moral relativism, right. As you point out, he did not kill millions of people. He didn't cause giant economic damage to people.
I would go so far to say that if you looked at what happened over a weekend in Hollywood, sex with multiple partners outside of marriage of both genders, indulgence in magical rituals, and inclusion of drugs and alcohol. Yeah, that happened. Right. So, I mean, that's what he did. Okay, at the time, that was so, taboo that, yeah, he got that kind of label. But, I mean, in the modern world, I don't know if it's good or bad. Some might argue either way. But that kind of activity that got him that label is so common these days.
Right. I think we've talked about it on the show before, and on the conversation we had outside of this interview, my belief that if he were alive today, he would fit right in with the sort of Kardashian social media world. He liked to be in the newspaper. He seemed to like to sort of manage his image quite a bit. So
he did. Well, he did early on. I think, as he got older, and we have to remember, this is a guy that had a public presence for decades. It's not like he was a shot in the dark who kind of appeared in the early 20th century, was a figure of the moment and then disappeared. He was in the public eye across both sides of the Atlantic in the English-speaking world for decades. His activities, his writing, his books, his painting, all of these, his theatrical activities and his ceremonial magic and his political ideas, all of that were continually being discussed in the newspapers of his day. And so we have decades of his exposure, and he was very sensationalistic. Very media attention grabbing in his 20s and early 30s that I think later in his life he found became more of an impediment to his spiritual teachings, or the goals that he had as being a religious prophet were hindered in many cases by the image and persona he had put forward in his younger years.
So most of our listeners are going to know, let do what thou wilt be the whole of the law, right? They're going to know that line. But what what exactly does that mean, and what was the goal of his breakaway religion, the OTO?
Well, first of all, the OTO existed before Crowley.
Okay.
This was one of those fringe Masonic groups that was started. It was started in Germany. There's a number of founders. Probably the most prominent is Royce and then Kellner. And so they had this very underdeveloped Masonic group. And one of the things that they included in it was sex magic. And so when Royce became acquainted with Crowley, he offered Crowley the opportunity to be head of the OTO of the English-speaking world. And Crowley accepted. And so within that context, Crowley had already received his prophetic channeling of a book of the law. Now, the context in which it was received is frequently debated. He claimed basically that there was a preternatural presence who dictated it to him while he was in Egypt, and that this took place over the course of 3 days. But again, the details of this changed slightly over time. And so it's not worth getting bogged down in it. In the English-speaking OTO, he adopted his book, The Book of the Law, as a foundation of the English OTO. He reworked the initiations that he got to include this Book of the Law, which has a system he called Thelema, which means will in Greek. And so it is within that context he started propagating the ideas of Thelema within the OTO. But he also started another group, one modeled very much after the Golden Dawn, and even preceding his involvement with the OTO, that he called the AA. And what that AA stands for is variable and depends on people's levels of initiation and knowledge. So I won't even, again, go there. Each one of these subjects can become very, very deep and take a long tangent. But that one was very much a Thelemic initiatory group, where he's taking the Golden Dawn system, taking Thelema and his ideas about magic that developed. And that's the one that these two groups are evolving independently, but overlapping in the sense that the memberships of one are frequently also in the other. And so there's no Church of Thelema per se in the OTO, because the OTO is a Masonic group doing Masonic-like rites. You have your magical group, the AA, and eventually Crowley also participates in getting ordained within the Gnostic Catholic Church. And we should also understand that just as there are all of these fringe kind of Masonic groups, within the notions of apostolic succession coming out of the church, there's all of these apostolic groups. And for people who don't know what that is according to the Roman Catholic Church, Jesus appointed Peter to be the person that the church is founded on, Cephas the Rock. And so all of the bishops that come out of the Catholic Church go through a physical laying on of hands that put them in what is called apostolic succession. And so there's this long continuous chain of making people bishops, and that there was a physical interaction between two people, one that had that interaction previously and the new one who has that one. And once that's done, it can never be undone. But there have been people who were in the church, got apostolic succession, but then were thrown out of the Roman Catholic Church. Well, they still have apostolic succession. They were bishops, and they theoretically can pass it on, and they do. So you get these lines of apostolic succession outside of the Roman Catholic Church. The church frowns upon this, but they can't deny the continuity of these lines. And the participants document it, you know, saying so-and-so consecrated so-and-so at this date and this location, et cetera. But then you have other people who are claiming they were consecrated without any documentation. And then finally, you also have systems of apostolic succession in which it doesn't trace itself to the Catholic Church, but it traces itself to a mystical experience of where Jesus appears and gives somebody apostolic succession and restarts a line that was either lost or didn't exist. And one of those lines is the Gnostic Catholic Church, and there's a mystical experience that a French person has, and they start a line, and so you get this kind of convergence of all these different lines. And by the way, I'll point out one of these kinds of restarts is also found in Mormonism. So this is another tradition that has the priesthood of the Melchizedek, but that one was reconstituted by Jesus to Joseph Smith. So this is not an uncommon practice. It is one, though, that you either have it within or outside of the church. And so we see it happening to Crowley, and he creates the Gnostic Catholic Church. And I'll also note that the Old Catholic Church, which is another Gnostic one, was integrated into theosophy with Leadbeater, and they created the Liberal Catholic Church through that Gnostic progression. And that exists today.
I've heard of that. I didn't know what it was. Okay, that's interesting.
So you have this connection again with this fringe apostolic succession and these Gnostic churches. And there's numerous Gnostic churches that exist today that are arising from claims of apostolic succession, coming either from lines coming from the Catholic Church or through these other kinds of mystical experiences. So there are three independent things ultimately with Crowley: the OTO, his AA, and the Gnostic Catholic Church. And all of them incorporate Thelema in some way or another.
So what's Crowley's goal with Thelema? What's he trying to accomplish here?
He's trying to spread it as a world religion.
Okay. And then what's it like? I mean, what are the tenets of Thelema? How does it compare to other religions?
Well, the first thing that is at the core of Thelema is it accentuates the individual over the group. And this is actually one of the things that is very hard for a lot of people to accept about that tradition, is that the individual is empowered to the level that their spiritual will, their goals, their reason for being trumps everything else. So if you look at most religious systems, it's about the religion itself and the individual sacrificing themselves, their will, their desire, turning it over to God's will or something like that. Crowley, being someone who was very interested in exemplifying the individual, has a system in which the individual comes first. So the individual's will, their goals, what they're trying to accomplish in their lives and on a spiritual, transcendent, Gnostic, or even just mundane level, becomes the first and foremost consideration. That's why it's "do what thou wilt shall be the whole of the law," right? It's that will of the individual is totalizing. Everything else is subsumed within the will. Now, it may actually be the will of the individual to make sacrifices, to subvert what they want to the good of a group. But they have to make that choice. It's not an assumed. And it's not a system that says if you're being selfish and putting the self first, then you're bad, right? That's how it is in so many other Abrahamic tradition, right? Individual has to subsume to the will of God or the group. Crowley's the opposite. And so that's the basis of "do what thou wilt." Now, that doesn't mean do what you want, because doing what you want is a very kind of whimsical, influenced in so many different ways, right? You're sitting there and watching TV and an ad comes on for some type of food or sweet or some activity or something like that. And you're like, ooh, that looks good. Oh, I want to do that. I mean, that's what want levels are at. Will is a much more fundamental basis. It's the core of what you are and what you are living for. It's much more subtle. It's more philosophical, and it's not so obvious. And so the rest of the system is to understand what your will is. So ceremonial magic is part of that process of discovering what your will is. And part of that system is there is a being or entity of some kind named or that he calls the Holy Guardian Angel. And the nature of that angel is frequently debated. Sometimes he talks about the angel as being a separate entity. Sometimes it's the higher self. Sometimes it's both. So it's not clear to those outside, but supposedly those who have encountered their Holy Guardian Angel, that duality or that confusion is cleared up. And that being helps guide you as you come to understand what your will is.
Well, within that context, this would be something that would be unique to each participant. They would get their own personal guardian angel if they wanted to go through that ritual. Is that right?
They don't get one. They have one.
They have one. Okay.
But that doesn't...
To contact it.
Right. Now, that could be contacting the higher self, like some portion of their consciousness that exists on a higher spiritual plane. That could be contacting an external entity. At one point, Crowley identifies the being that dictated the Book of the Law to him as his holy guardian angel. So is that being part of his mind, and did he write it in a trance nature, or is it a separate being that was in the room with him dictating it to him? These are some of the debates about the context in which the book was received.
What year was this that he sort of put this together and published?
The book was received in 1904.
Okay.
But he didn't do anything with it for a few years, and in fact, he misplaced it for a while. And later he found it around 1907, and it was then that he realized it had greater spiritual import than just some kind of trance writing. And that's when he started building his systems around it. So the first one was the AA, and then later the OTO, and then the Gnostic Catholic Church.
Interesting. So ultimately, over the course of his life, he had published several works. He had tried to build up these groups. What ends up happening? Like, are all these groups that he started, are they all still extant, or did some of them survive, some not? Or what's his legacy looking like now?
Well, I think you could look at his legacy in a lot of different ways. His influence as a whole is pretty tremendous. He's looked at for his rebelliousness. He's looked at for his literary skill in both his poetry and his writings of novels and short stories. He's looked at as a kind of spiritual renegade or libertarian or hedonist by some. So they see him as a model of rejecting the status quo and the system and instead making one's own way. Some look at him as a painter. Most recently, some paintings of his has been discovered, but he also, during a period that he lived in Germany, in Berlin, that he did an art show there. So there was a number of different ways that people look at him and become inspired by him. Definitely within the arts, he's inspirational in film, dance, music, literature, visual arts. he's referenced quite frequently. But then also these groups, they all exist today. Some exist in a multiplicity, so there's lots of groups that call themselves the AA. There's a few groups that call themselves the OTO, and so there are conflicts within their community of participants who argue about the legitimacy of any one group or another. And then you also have the Gnostic Catholic Church, which continues. And there are those who participate in the Gnostic Catholic Church outside of the OTO context. And since the late 20th century, the Gnostic Catholic Church within the OTO, although they were independent, the memberships were overlapping, and at one point they were combined. And so there's a confluence between participation in the OTO and its initiatory degrees also necessitates, even in nominally, participation in the Gnostic Catholic Church. And so that as you go through the initiations, you're actually being initiated in the OTO as well as receiving titles within the Gnostic Catholic Church.
Interesting. So ultimately, within his life, when he passes away, what was his status at that point? Was he like well revered? Was he doing okay financially, or was he struggling, or like, you know, I in the sort of classic, not talking about from a spiritual perspective, but just from like a how well was he being taken care of at the end of his life? Was he successful in that sort of a capitalistic perspective? Like, where was
no he? Okay. Not at all.
Okay.
He basically died living in a small rented room of a person's house in England, relatively poor. He would get visitors, but his organizations were in shambles, if they even existed at all. He was trying to find people to carry on his legacy. He was somewhat successful. He did have a successor in the OTO, a guy named Carl Germer, who continued the OTO and the AA. Germer was much more interested in the AA particularly. As far as the EGC, he had some who participated and were interested in that. And then there were a smattering of people who became involved and interested in Crowley's work towards the end of his life that carried on his work after he passed away in December of 1947.
And what did he die of? Or do we know?
I don't know. It is known off the top of my head. I don't remember.
Okay.
I think it was very mundane, just a normal kind of illness.
Gotcha.
Like, I'd have to look it up, but something like pneumonia or something.
Gotcha.
Like that. It's, I mean, one thing we should keep in mind is that he was a heroin addict for almost his whole life. He did times try to stop. Short periods of times he was more successful than others, but he was taking heroin up to his death. And so a lot of his time, you know, was engaged in that kind of activity.
Sure. It's complicated too, I think, when there's so many of these rituals that involve opening up your mind with drugs. I gotta suspect if you use heroin, it doesn't take much to get you completely addicted. It's tough. It's very, yeah.
Well, I think another context that we have to keep in mind is at the time that he started using heroin, it was legal and it was actually seen as a viable medication for the treatment of asthma.
Wow.
And that was a condition that he had. And so heroin was prescribed. It was only later when that ended and medical science saw, you know, the repercussions of people who became addicted to heroin.
Yeah.
And the fact that it there were better solutions, that they stopped seeing it as a proper treatment But then it was the damage was already done to Crowley and who knows how many other people. And then cocaine was also prescribed for illness. And so the drugs that we think are illegal today and bad in some context or not, that's a relatively recent phenomenon.
Right, right.
And the impact of those drugs was not well known until well into the 20th century.
Well, it's important to remind listeners that heroin was a brand name. I mean, that's I've seen a lot of the packaging for heroin and cocaine being used in a variety of things, including Coca-Cola. The coca part of Coca-Cola used to be from the coca.
Right. I mean, you could go to your pharmacist and pick up cocaine pills like nothing. I mean, they were cheap.
Yeah. Amazing. Well, John, I feel like we could just keep talking about this, but I probably do need to wind down here. There is this will seem like a non sequitur, but for regular listeners, this is a thing. I try to ask people who come on the show this one common closing question. Are you ready?
Mm-hmm.
What's your favorite monster?
The Creature from the Black Lagoon.
Is it really? Awesome.
Yeah. I used to, my father was in the military and I grew up for a period of time during the elementary years in Honolulu. And they used to have a creature double feature on the weekends.
Nice.
And they would do a Godzilla film and some other old, horror film. And I just absolutely loved watching The Creature from the Black Lagoon.
Have you managed to go see The Shape of Water?
No, not yet.
Oh, you should totally go see that. I think you'll get a real kick out of it. It's not directly from that tradition, but it certainly has been heavily impacted. Guillermo del Toro does a fantastic job. It's a great story, but it's one of the most beautiful films I've ever seen, but a great Gilman. So it's really, really fun. I think you would really get a kick out of it. So check it out if you get a chance.
Will do. Will do.
Is this a good...
But thank you for having me on the show and appreciate everybody's time in listening.
I really appreciate you taking the time. This is such a complicated topic, which I think people will have a pretty good handle on now. And I'll have to edit this down just a little bit, but this is really good material. And thank you so much for helping us contextualize the role of Crowley within this larger esoterica. Because as it fits in with this magical research stuff, I think it's really important, and I don't think he's well understood. He's much more commonly a pop culture sort of reference point than a better understood sort of figure within Western history. So
mm-hmm.
I think you're going to help people sort of clear some of that mystery up. I appreciate it.
I'm glad to do so. Thanks for having me on.
Monster Talk.
You've been listening to Monster Talk, the science show about monsters. I'm Blake Smith, and today you heard an interview with John L. Crow about the life of Aleister Crowley. I hope you'll check out the links in the show notes at monstertalk.org, where there's a lot of information if you'd like to dig deeper into Crowley's strange but interesting life. He somehow got a reputation for outsized evil and wickedness, yet in a century that saw mass human eradication, carpet bombing, unlawful medical experiments, global wars, and nuclear bombs, somehow his life, by comparison, seems almost quaint. But he sure seems to have messed up a lot of lives, including his own. Often we have higher aspirations than our ability or fortunes allow us to execute. I certainly see the appeal of a philosophy that talks about will. According to many interpretations, when Crowley said, "Do what thou wilt," he was talking about living for one's true purpose, following your will with purpose, not doing whatever pops in your head, divining your true purpose. But despite the heroic stories we hear about loners with incredible force of will and how they accomplish amazing things, it always seems to me that when you dig a little deeper, more has actually been accomplished by the cooperation of people who share a vision than by individuals who seek credit and accolades. But this has been a show about Aleister Crowley, not his teachings. There are some links in the show notes if you want to learn more about that. Monster Talk is an official podcast of Skeptic Magazine. But the opinions expressed on this show are those of myself and my guests, and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of Skeptic Magazine or the Skeptic Society. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of Monster Talk. Each episode, we strive to bring you the best in monster-related content with a focus on bringing scientific skepticism into the conversation. If you enjoy Monster Talk, we now have a variety of ways to support the show, all with convenient links at monstertalk.org/support. That's monstertalk.org/support. There we have links to our Patreon pages as well as a donation button. A great way to support the show is to buy us books from our Amazon Monster Talk wish list, which directly helps us with our research. We love used books very much, so don't feel compelled to buy new ones, and we love Kindle, and we can share our digital library with each other. Finally, without spending any money at all, you can support us by leaving a positive review at iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Positive reviews help keep us visible in iTunes, which is a great way to help us find new listeners. And please, share our show on your favorite social media platforms. Monster Talk theme music's by Peach Stealing Monkeys. As always, thank you so much for listening.
Want to stay abreast of the latest from Skeptic Magazine and the Skeptic Society? Want cutting-edge skeptical articles delivered straight to your inbox every week? Then subscribe to eSkeptic, the free electronic newsletter of the Skeptic Society. Visit skeptic.com to sign up.